It is Monday, October the 22nd. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you here. Coming up, latest on the death of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi.
It strikes really at the heart of the West's engagement with the Middle East and with Saudi Arabia, the West's engagement with totalitarian regimes, and also, of course, the issue of journalism and journalists.
U.S. pulling out of the INF treaty. President Trump wants to keep Central American migrants out of the U.S.
I will seal off the border before they come into this country, and I'll bring out our military, not our reserves. I'll bring out our military.
Also ahead, a little something from the world of music. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Saudi Arabia says it made a huge and grave mistake in the killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi inside its Istanbul consulate and vowed those responsible for it would be held accountable. Foreign Minister Adel Abdujaber told Fox News here in the U.S. Saudi agents did this out of the scope of their authority, calling it a rogue operation, spoke about the Saudi government investigation of what happened in Istanbul.
We had reports that indicated that he left the consulate. And then, as I mentioned, our investigating team in Turkey discovered that there are elements that were contradict what was in the report. When we ascertained ourselves of this fact, then the public prosecutor launched his investigation, and he determined that the reports that was originally filed were wrong, and that there was something that happened that was criminal. And as a consequence, we took the steps we took. Brett, keep in mind, when you have a situation like this, you want the information that you put out to be as accurate as you possibly can.
Abdujaber offered his condolences to the Khashoggi family, but disclosed no new information about how the writer was killed, where his body is, or if Crown Prince Mohammed Al bin Salman, the country's de facto ruler, was involved. Khashoggi was living in the U.S. in self-imposed exile, writing columns for the Washington Post newspaper, all of them critical of the Crown Prince and of Saudi Arabia's intervention in the conflict in Yemen. For some perspective on how the Saudis have handled their investigation and other events since Khashoggi went missing in early October, VOA's Victor Beatty spoke with Anthony Billingsley, a political analyst and senior lecturer in Middle East Studies at the University of New South Wales.
Well, I think their biggest problem, Victor, is to protect Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman from blame involvement. So what we do, we've got a couple of four guys already, one of whom, whose name is Al-Asiri, which would suggest he's from the Asir area of Saudi Arabia, i.e. not one of the main ruling families, and therefore vaguely expendable. And so this whole process is to try and find some way of producing a vaguely plausible reason for excusing the prince from any involvement in this.
The Crown Prince, of course, is heir to the throne. Is that now in jeopardy, do you think?
Look, I think at the moment the other members of the broader family are probably too divided. It depends, what happens with the various security forces. And over that period where he had half the family in, well, sort of jail, he seemed to have gained control of most of those. So it's a matter of whether those members of the family can start to really assert themselves, given the damage that this is causing to Saudi Arabia as a whole.
We've seen a number of reactions from European countries, none of them very good. President Trump, in an interview with the Washington Post late Saturday, said obviously there's been deception and there have been lies. Their stories are all over the place. What is this going to do with relations between Saudi Arabia and the international community?
From the West's point of view, I think Saudi Arabia remains important for their regional strategies. Saudi presents itself as the only bulwark against Iran. To the extent that that's in itself credible is rather debatable, I think. But that's the sort of role that they see themselves in and being useful to the West in that respect. So the West hasn't got anybody else really to rely on. The Emiratis are too small. Iraq, which could have played that role, is still in too much of a mess to be able to contribute much. So, the Saudis are there as the bulwark.
Turkish President Erdogan on Sunday vowed to reveal within days before Parliament what he called the naked truth over the death of journalist Khashoggi. Could this be the other shoe that falls that really could seal it for the Saudi prince as far as his future is concerned?
Well, it certainly could be the shoe that falls that leads to basically global acceptance that the prince was involved. How far it goes beyond that, it remains to be seen. It's very hard to know what Erdogan is about here, because on one hand there's considerable regional rivalry between Turkey and Saudi Arabia, both of which are Sunni states, but they are divided over the Muslim Brotherhood. And so Turkey supporting Qatar against the Saudis and that sort of thing going on. So there's a very complex relationship that's working its way through at the moment. I think that Erdogan may have been hoping to use the dispute to improve his relationship with the United States. That's not entirely clear that that's working at the moment. And so, you know, it's still very unclear. But if he does release in its fullness the transcript and the audio of what happened, well, that's going to be a very damaging thing for the Saudis.
Why is this such a big story?
It strikes really at the heart of the West's engagement with the Middle East and with Saudi Arabia, the West's engagement with totalitarian regimes, and also, of course, the issue of journalism and journalists. But everybody has been very excited at the idea that Mohammed bin Salman was going to be a reformist who was going to, allow women to drive, as if that's a really dramatic achievement for women. And this behavior in foreign policy and domestic policy that's been demonstrated over quite some months now is really disrupting that sort of image that he's been trying to project and the West has been very keen to acknowledge.
The Saudi nemesis Iran has been unusually quiet about this incident. Does it stand to benefit somehow?
I think so. I mean, on one hand, the Iranians have got their own problems. They've got some very serious domestic issues that they're trying to deal with and serious power plays going on within the regime. But on the other hand, the Saudis' invasion of and attacks on Yemen and now this have all sort of reinforced the Iranian image or message that, you know, the problem is the Saudis, not the Iranians. Just got to say, I can't really see a long-term advantage to Iran because ultimately the West and the region, the Gulf states in particular, are going to say, well, what choice do we have? Can we really abandon the Saudis and walk away and say, well, let's be friends with the Iranians? And I can't see that as being a serious option at this stage.
That's Dr. Anthony Billingsley, a political analyst and senior lecturer in Middle East Studies at the University of New South Wales in Australia. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beattie. This is VOA.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
This is VOA's International Edition. President Trump says that he will be pulling the U.S. out of the so-called Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, the INF, because Russia has violated the pact. VOA's Lori London spoke with Atlantic Council Deputy Director for Strategy, Matthew Kronig, asking him about the treaty and how Russia might be violating it.
So the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, some consider to be the most successful arms control treaty in history. It banned an entire class of missiles, intermediate range missiles with ranges from 500 to 5,500 kilometers. So it was signed in 1987. Before then, the United States and Russia had thousands of missiles in this range pointed at each other. After this treaty, we eliminated them altogether. Russia is violating the treaty. President Putin started talking about this in the mid-2000s. He said this is crazy. The two largest nuclear superpowers on Earth, the United States and Russia are the only countries not building these systems. China, India, Pakistan, other countries are. But rather than pulling out of the treaty, President Putin decided to just cheat. So he started testing, building and testing these missiles. The Obama administration accused him of cheating on the treaty in 2014. And just recently, NATO officials have said that Russia has gone forward and actually deployed these missiles. So they're ready for use. So this is a real problem.
Why, if they are cheating and the president is correct, why is he getting criticism? I mean, he's getting a lot of pushback on this decision from members of his own party. And even Mikhail Gorbachev said, you know, this is not a decision of a great mind. I mean, that was quite a statement.
I think the way he went about the announcement is somewhat unusual for a treaty of this magnitude, you know, making it kind of part of a stump speech in Nevada. Is an unusual way to announce this. I think usually you'd want something more ceremonious. So I think that's part of what's leading to the criticism. But there is actually quite a bit of bipartisan expert support for this move. One, you've got to show Russia that there are costs to violating the treaty. And two, many experts of our policy in Asia have said that having these capabilities would be really helpful for countering China and China's recent aggressiveness in Asia. Because China's not bound by this treaty at all, and they've got a lot of missiles in this space.
Would it, though, not be sort of similar to some of the arguments that were made about leaving the Iran deal, that even a deal that isn't perfect is better than no deal at all? Does this leave the world open to even more danger by not having anything?
A couple of points. Iran was, by all accounts, abiding by the terms of that deal. Russia, by all accounts, is cheating on this deal, and there's really no disagreement on that. They've been doing it for over 5 years. Again, the Obama administration was the first to point that out. So the argument for staying in would be the hope that, you know, eventually Russia would come around and decide to come back into compliance, and that was the Obama administration's hope in 2014. But I think now there's enough evidence, including the Russian deployments, that they're not really interested in coming back into compliance. So it's kind of up to the United States. Do we want to be played for a sucker and continue to abide by a treaty that no other country is living up to, or are we going to take some steps to build our own capabilities in this space?
What do you think happens from here?
It's a good question. You know, I think one of the better criticisms of this decision is that building a new missile system takes 7 to 10 years. So we've said we're pulling out, but you know, Russia has already deployed these capabilities. China has them. What do we do? Do we have plans in place to actually deploy similar missiles quickly? And I think the answer to that is no. The second issue is, how do our allies feel about this? Because these are intermediate range missiles. If they're to deal with Russia and China, then deploying them in the United States will be no good. We'd need to deploy them on the territory of allies in Europe and Asia. I think our allies in Europe are not going to be enthusiastic to take these capabilities. In Asia, it's a different story. There are significant concerns about China's growing power in Japan, Australia, and elsewhere. And so there, I suspect we could find some allies who would be eager to host these capabilities.
And has Russia reacted at all to the to Trump's decision announcement?
Well, they have. So they've criticized it. And you mentioned the Gorbachev criticism before. But, you know, I think the Russian reaction is a little bit disingenuous because, again, they've been cheating on this agreement for years. You know, the United States pulls out of agreements. As you pointed out, we've pulled out of the Iran agreement. But for all the criticisms you can levy, at least we're upfront about it. We don't cheat on agreements. If we're going to not live up to an agreement, we state our intention to withdraw. So Russia's really not behaved above board here. They've not pulled out of the treaty, they've pretended like it's still in place, and then they've systematically cheated on it.
Dr. Matthew Kronig, Deputy Director for Strategy in the Scowcroft Center for Strategy and Security, all of that at the Atlantic Council, and he was speaking with VOA's Lori London. President Trump says full efforts are being made to stop the caravan of thousands of Central American migrants currently in Mexico from crossing into the United States.
I will seal off the border before they come into this country, and I'll bring out our military, not our reserves. I'll bring out our military.
And Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto has said that he will do all he can to make sure these migrants do not bombard the U.S. border area. We asked Peter Hockham, President Emeritus and Senior Fellow at the Inter-American Dialogue, for his read on why so many people are leaving countries like Honduras.
It certainly reflects the terrible situation in Central America, whether it has to do with the security side of it, the economics of the region. I think it's just a sense of desperation. Governments have shown they're not can't count on them. Corruption is so widespread. I mean, this is a real crisis in Central America. It's clear that people want a way out, and they see the United States as a potential solution. Most people in the region by now have relatives in the United States or friends there, and clearly those that have made it to the United States are generally doing a lot better, and there's no way around it. And U.S. Aid, which was been intended over the years to help the countries grow, develop, provide services, and increase security of the populations, have really not done very, very much. The problem is not necessarily the programs themselves, but just the sort of the lack of effective institutions in the region, the high levels of crime, and also I think that the U.S. has not sort of invested the kinds of resources that are really needed to make a major shift in the fortunes of Central America.
Peter Hockham is President Emeritus and Senior Fellow at the Inter-American Dialogue. Meantime, the Red Cross says many of the migrants are suffering from dehydration as well as stomach infections and foot injuries as they walk the long journey. Walter Cotty, the Red Cross Regional Director for the Americas, said it is imperative that the dignity and security of families are safeguarded and that they are kept together. The Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, also known as DACA, is an American immigration policy allowing some individuals who were brought to the United States illegally as children to receive a renewable 2-year period of deferred action from deportation and become eligible for a work permit in the U.S. The Trump administration says that it will ask the high court to take up the decision to end these protections for undocumented young adults if a federal appeals court did not rule on that immigration issue by the end of the month. We get the story now from AP's Jackie Quinn.
President Trump ended the DACA program last year. It was an Obama-era initiative that shielded about 700,000 young adults from foreign countries who had been brought to the U.S. illegally as children. A California federal court required the program be continued for the existing participants, and the Trump administration appealed to the Ninth Circuit Court. That court still hasn't ruled, so now the Justice Department says if it doesn't get an answer by October 31st, it will ask the U.S. Supreme Court to take the case. Jackie Quinn, Washington.
And still ahead on International Edition, the sounds of O.C. Smith. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Researchers in Utah say what might be the world's largest organism is dying, but could be saved with what they call a mega conservation effort. The Pando aspen clone looks like a forest of trees, but since each of the trees is linked by common genetic markers and possibly one giant root system, scientists consider it to be a single giant living organism. Paul Rogers and Darren McAvoy from Utah State University say they have performed the first complete assessment of the Pando aspen, which is located in Utah's Fish Lake National Forest. They found that much of the Pando colony is failing, although a previously restored section of the clone trees continues to recover. The study suggests the thinning of the aspen clones is due to human development and damage caused by local wildlife such as the mule deer. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us here today. Guess what? It's time now for a little something from the world of music.
You know by now. you'll still be the only one. The years may come, the years may go, but my love remains the same.
O.C. Smith is an American musician who began as a jazz vocalist and later moved into country and R&B. He was hired to replace Joe Williams in the Count Basie band in the early 1960s after cutting some rather unsuccessful records in the 1950s. He sang with Basie's band from 1961 to 1963.
You're my fascination, every little thing I do. To spend forever with you. And that's why, after all is said and done, there's just no comparison that makes me feel the way I do every time I'm close to you. There could be no other. You bring me joy night and day. And when you really need me, girl, I'm just a heartbeat away.
After All Is Said and Done is one of the big hits with his fans. In 1985, O.C. Smith began to balance his work in the recording studio with his new passion for Christian ministry. But despite the fact that he founded his own church in Los Angeles, he continued to perform and record popular music. And always on his playlist was a cover of the Supreme song Stormy, to which O.C. added his genial jazz style.
You were the sunshine. Whenever you smile, but I called you Stormy today. All of a sudden, that old rain's falling down, and my world is cloudy and gray. Oh, you've gone away. Hey, storm.
Stormy.
Oh, storm.
Stormy.
Stormy.
Storm.
Bring back that sunny day.
Born in Mansfield, Louisiana, Smith moved with his parents to Little Rock, Arkansas, and then moved on with his mother to Los Angeles, California, after his parents divorced. He completed a psychology degree at Southern University and joined the Air Force. And he got his first break as a singer with Cy Oliver. And then, down the road a bit, O.C. recorded the Bobby Russell song Little Green Apples, which went to number 2 on the Billboard Hot 100, and won Russell the 1969 Grammy Award for Song of the Year. It also received a gold record.
Oh, I wake up in the morning with my hair down in my eyes, and she says hi. And I stumble to the breakfast table while the kids are going off to school goodbye. And she reaches out and takes my hand, squeezes it, and says,
"How you feeling,
hon?" Oh, yes. And I look across her smiling lips that warm my heart and see my morning sun. And if that's not loving me, then all I gotta say
God didn't make little green apples. It don't rain in Indianapolis in the summertime.
On November 23, 2001, O.C. Smith died of a heart attack. He was 69 and was survived by his wife Robbie, his four children with former wife Lorraine, and 10 grandchildren. Shortly after his death, Governor Jim Hodges proclaimed O.C. Smith Day in the state of South Carolina. He was posthumously elected to the Carolina Beach Music Hall of Fame in 2002.
Sometimes I call up at home, knowing she's busy.
Yeah, it really doesn't get much smoother than O.C. Smith. Love it. Love it so. Hey, listen, thanks everyone for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Always good to have you here. The latest world news is straight ahead. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, John Ellison, I'm Steve Norman in Washington, hoping you have a super Monday. Now a bit more from O.C. Smith.
But she sits waiting patiently, smiles when she first sees me, 'cause she's made that way. If that's not loving me, all I gotta say, God didn't make little green apples. It don't snow many apples when the winter comes. And there's no such thing as make believe, puppy dolls, autumn leaves, and BB guns. God didn't make little green apples. It don't rain in Indianapolis in the summertime.
This is Today in History. On October 22, 451, the Council of Chalcedon adopted a landmark church creed regarding the nature of Jesus Christ. The council's statement is generally accepted by both Protestant and Roman Catholic Christians. In 1797, Frenchman André Jacques Garnerin made the first significant parachute jump. He leaped from a hydrogen balloon nearly 1,000 meters above Paris. He failed to include an air vent at the top of his prototype. He oscillated wildly in descent, but landed safely, shaken but unhurt. October 22nd in 1844 was a day of anticipation for followers of American preacher William Miller, who had predicted the end of the world and the return of Christ. Nothing happened, and the following day became known simply as the Great Disappointment. Miller's followers later founded the Seventh-day Adventist Church. In 1879, Thomas Edison tested the first really successful incandescent electric lamp. Earlier attempts by other inventors had not resulted in a commercially viable method of producing light with electricity. In 1962, President John F. Kennedy announced that U.S. spy planes had discovered Soviet missile bases in Cuba from which nuclear missiles could be launched at major U.S. cities. He ordered a naval blockade of Cuba, telling Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev the threat would not be tolerated. After a tense two-week standoff, Khrushchev agreed to remove Soviet missile capability from Cuba, and Kennedy promised to refrain from interfering in Cuban internal affairs. Kennedy also agreed to remove U.S. missiles in Turkey. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
This is